Hey everyone, Chat Cemetery is back. I'm your host, Deanna Chapman, and today I am joined once again by Panda Haddon, and we are talking about Gwendy's Button Box. This is a nice, quick novella, and you know, it's what, like a 2-hour read, would you say, Panda?
Yeah, I think that's actually about how long it took me. It was definitely like one of those, like I curled up in the bathtub to read it, and the water didn't even have time to get cold. It's quick.
Yeah. I was like, ooh, pictures.
Yes. No, the art that they did for this was very, very nice. Not only the cover art, but also the kind of in-between chapter pieces that they did. They very much set the mood.
Yeah. And we should note that this was a co-write between Stephen King and Richard Chismar. He's done this before with Peter Straub twice with The Talisman, and then the follow-up, Black House. So this is not unfamiliar territory for him. And, you know, for anyone who maybe isn't as familiar with Richard Chismar, he runs Cemetery Dance Publications, and he's put out a ton of special editions of King books. And I was lucky enough to find the Cemetery Dance hardcover for Gwendy's at like a used bookstore for way less than they sell it for new.
Oh, wow.
So
nice.
I was pretty stoked on that. And I haven't had the chance to read any of his solo work. I did get a free copy of Widow's Point because I pre-ordered one of his other books, and it's sitting on my shelf waiting to be read. It's roughly, you know, looks roughly the same size as Gwendy, so I'm stoked that it's a short one, but you know, King reading has to take priority. But Panda, are you familiar at all with Richard's work?
I'm not. This was actually the first time that I had heard of him. I believe I've heard of his company before. I think they've gone back and done editions of several like old horror books, if I'm remembering the company correctly.
I'm really only familiar with like their versions of Salem's Lot and Carrie and stuff. They've done like really nice hardcover versions that are a little out of my price range. But, you know, I know a lot of people love collecting their hardcovers and things like that. So just a quick note there. But, you know, a lot of people say they can tell when, for instance, King was writing versus Peter Straub, because I think they have fairly different styles. And I've never really been one to pay attention to that. And I didn't pick up on that here either. Maybe I'm just dumb. I don't know.
So I honestly couldn't tell you like how clearly it was split. I know that this whole thing, that Gwendy's came as a collaboration because King couldn't figure out a way to end the story. And then they went back and forth on it. And interviews have kind of implied that it's pretty well split. I can obviously see, you know, some of King's touches here, particularly with the descriptions of the setting and the characters.
Yes.
And also just the way that he writes youths is very much present. The age is very appropriate for Gwendy throughout the entire novella. And I think the other piece that is definitely King, in my opinion, is his ability to write like many women's like greatest fears when it comes to being approached by a stranger. He definitely has a very frightening flair for violence and women. And it turned out very strong in this, both at the start with Gwendy's fear of meeting the man in black, and then at the end with her experience being attacked.
I'll be totally honest. At first, I didn't catch on that this was tied to Randall Flagg, because King has written so many characters that I sometimes just see a character name and I'm like, okay, creepy dude. All right, what else is new? kind of thing. So it was what I was kind of reading up in preparation for this episode. I was like, you know what? That makes a lot of sense.
And the other thing about it is that Randall Flagg appearing in different things kind of has like a different aura to him in almost every story.
Yep.
And this one especially like has this very like nonchalant, playful, matter-of-fact way that doesn't completely fit in other versions.
Yeah, this character in Richard Ferris really kind of gave me Leland Gaunt feels from Needful Things.
Yeah, I could definitely see that.
I was waiting for like the long fingers to come out and take the box or something like that, you know? And because of this guy kind of feeling a little older, maybe, than I think I typically picture Randall Flagg. I think that's where the disconnect there was for me. But obviously, his name is Richard Ferris, RF, Randall Flagg. King's not trying to pull the wool over anyone's eyes with this one, you know. I just wasn't really thinking about the Dark Tower because the Dark Tower had been finished by the time, you know, this came out. But leave it to King to connect everything. And what I do like about this is that it doesn't just cover, you know, like 1 year of Gwendy's life. He's been doing more things that cover longer periods of time. You know, Revival covers decades. This covers quite a bit of time because it starts when Gwendy is 12, and you get these real Stranger Danger vibes at the beginning of the story, and yet she still talks to the strange man.
Yeah, and I mean, that definitely makes it, you know, a period piece of the time that it takes place in. I think the story itself starts in 1973 or 1974.
I believe it's 74.
So that extra Stranger Danger isn't quite there, but like, we do get the same sense that Gwendy does that, no, I definitely shouldn't be talking to this man, but also there's something alluring about it. There's real life element like throughout this. This story particularly resonated with me. And really, I think for anyone who's kind of wished for something to fix all of their struggles in their life, you know, being perceived as ugly and eventually changing that is something that many people can relate to. It's a common experience. But in particular, being perceived as an ugly girl and then having attention from someone that seems positive and being like, okay, I'll see what this person wants is a scary experience that so many people have experienced. But going through Gwendy throughout her life, like, I think the writing for her changed so well. I've said obviously multiple times that King writes youth really well, but throughout this, the writing ages very well with Gwendy.
And it's very clear that the times when he does write youth characters very well is almost like in the time period when he grew up as a kid or when his kids were growing up, it seems. And you get this sense that a lot of these youth stories take place in a very specific time period. You know, you have the Losers Club in the late 50s coming together. You have Carrie, which I believe just takes place when it was written in the late 70s. This is the 70s again, and you get a sense that it's easier for him to write youth in a certain time period when the world was really quite different than it is now. And if I'm not mistaken, I think the Institute maybe brings one of these kinds of stories into, you know, more present day. But as far as a lot of his child characters go, they were of a very different time than maybe, you know, like when you and I grew up, because I'm a 90s kid and Stranger Danger was like super big then.
It also adds this element of there's less things that can save you.
Yeah.
It makes sense that he would write during periods of time when he was a kid or when he had his own kids, because then he could actually observe them and write them well. Writing modern children would be much harder without, you know, access to their daily life. But not only that, you know, it gets around the Stranger Danger, the technology, things like that. Characters have to think more on their feet and not have such an easy way to solve their problems. Not saying that technology solves everything, but it's a lot easier to base a story in a period of time where when the car breaks down, you don't just pull up AAA on your phone or Google directions where you need to go.
Or you can call 911 if you are not home.
Exactly.
That's kind of really wild to think about, that if something happened to you while you were like out and about, you were just screwed.
No, I think about that a lot. One of the things my mom used to do with me as a child, she would put me and my brother in the car and she would just drive and we would go on some kind of adventure to go to like some historical like place or like some nature park. We wouldn't have a cell phone. We'd have maybe a paper map and that's it. If anything happened, like, you know, there's no telling. And now, like, If I don't pick up the phone for my grandma after she's called twice, she's like, where were you? Something could have happened. You left the house without your phone? Very different time to live in.
Yeah, and I was a kid at the very tail end of that. I want to say my parents probably had a cell phone late 90s, early 2000s, so probably by the time I was 9 or 10 or something like that. And you think about these things now, and this is obviously something that resonates with King, and I think that shows. And, you know, I believe Richard Chismar is maybe like 50-something. I'm not 100% sure. Please don't quote me on that. I will look it up as I talk here. But, you know, they're a slightly different generation. And the fact that that still was able to shine through in this novella, I think worked really well.
And not only that, I personally think that they did a very good job writing a young female character, not only just one young female character, but multiple, because not only do we hear, you know, from Gwendy, we also hear from her friends, in particular, her best friend Olive, and the jealousy that came from the gifts that the button box gave her.
Yeah. Richard Chismar is 55, so I was in the ballpark. So, you know, but he still would have grown up in that same sort of era roughly as Stephen King's kids. So, you know, they kind of have that shared experience. I'm sure it was even more drastic when King was a kid, because I don't know what the status of, you know, payphones. There we go.
Payphones. There we go. Oh, and in Maine?
Yeah. Too? I can't believe I just blanked so hard on that word.
We don't see them that often anymore.
No, there are definitely people who don't even know what a payphone is. So, you know, when King was growing up, especially like you said in Maine, payphones probably weren't super popular even then. I don't know if payphones were ever popular in Maine, let's be honest. But
so much of his stories are rural. If the town he was in had one, that would have probably been a big deal.
Yeah, and granted, I grew up in Orange County, California, which is not rural by any stretch of the imagination, but where I am now in Colorado, it's more like, you know, you drive into the quote-unquote town, there's your Walmart, Safeway, a few restaurants, and then, you know, little strip malls and stuff like that, and that's kind of it out here, unless you want to drive into the actual city. So it's given me a slightly different perspective on these things, because it's like I open the back door and you can see the forest. So, you know, it's not like we're out in the middle of nowhere where there's absolutely nothing, but it definitely feels maybe more along the lines of, I don't even know if Bangor would be an apt comparison, but I imagine, you know, if this town had existed, you know, at the same time that Bangor came around, it would probably look pretty similar. Because I imagine in Maine, a lot of the shops and stuff are like locally owned and things like that. I mean, obviously Walmart and Safeway are not locally owned by any stretch of the imagination here, but you still have like family-owned restaurants and things like that here, but I imagine Maine, it's even more so that way. Sure, they probably have a Walmart or a few in Maine now, but not when King was growing up.
No, definitely not. I mean, back then, it predominantly would have been family-owned things. You wouldn't have seen those major grocery stores, even leading up into the 70s. A lot of that, I don't want to say modernization, but the takeover of big business didn't start happening until probably the early 70s.
Yeah, that sounds about right. And, you know, we've strayed a little from the story here, but I think just painting the picture of small towns the way that King does is so crucial to the stories. And you really get the feeling here that even if Gwendy isn't friends with everyone, she kind of knows who everyone in town is. And you even have, you know, the coin guy who she sells her coins to. And he's like, are you sure you don't want to call your parents to come get you, kind of thing? And it's just this place where everyone kind of looks out for everyone. Everyone knows who the troublemakers are. And you see that with It. You see it with Carrie. You see it with so many of his stories. And, you know, I don't think Gwendy is necessarily my favorite of the kids he's written in the last 5 decades now, I guess. It's been many decades, but
I'll agree with that. Yeah, definitely.
I think she's compelling enough. Well, obviously, one, to where they're doing a trilogy.
Yes, I was actually going to talk about that here in a little bit. I was surprised to find out that this is going to be turned into a trilogy. Not only that, so we had the second one come out by just Richard Chismar.
Yeah.
And that was Gwendy's Magic Feather?
Yes. I have not read that yet, though.
So that came out in November 2019. However, a year later, November 2020, so just a few months ago, Chismar announced that he and King are collabing again, but it's going to be a full-length novel this time instead of just a novella.
And in this story, we kind of just get bits and pieces of Gwendy's life strung together by this box, which we haven't even really talked about the box, but
we haven't.
I know this is a novella, so we probably don't have too much to say here, so I like to kind of let us go on tangents a little on these kinds of episodes. But she gets this box from Richard Ferris, who we have determined is in fact Randall Flagg, the man in black, whatever other name you want to call him, because he has about 800 of them. And it has 8 buttons on top, 2 levers on the sides. And, you know, the buttons kind of represent the continents. And then there's a red and black button that have no specific location, designation, whatever you want to call it. And she gets these little chocolates. And it's kind of like these chocolates are giving her good luck. She used to have to study, now she doesn't have to study, and she still gets amazing grades. Everything is going right for her as long as she keeps eating these chocolates. And she even has, you know, a couple things go wrong, but in the grand scheme of things, that happens to everyone. Not everyone is going to be on such a hot streak like Gwendy and, you know, expect everything to stay perfect, you know. So she has a falling out with her friend Olive. And she kind of just brushes it off after a short period of time, and it circles back later in the story. And I really like how everything kind of came full circle by the end of it. You know, there was this boy who used to kind of terrorize her. He comes back around and actually physically attacks her and her boyfriend this time. So, you know, obviously not a great scenario, but the fact that they are able to, in such a short amount of time, especially for King, have all of this come back around and just give us this sort of glimpse at a decent stretch of Gwendy's life, I thought was really well done.
Oh, absolutely. Like I said, it did a very good job in terms of like writing, fleshing out the characters in that short amount of time, because with the chocolates that she receives from the box, it does a lot of things. It helps her lose weight. It clears her skin. It makes it so she's not injured as easily. And then other things seem to happen, such as her parents' alcoholism ending and their marriage getting better. The box being there causes all of these good things while simultaneously taking things away from her. Olive gets so jealous because of all these things that happen to Gwendy, and because it's become so normalized for Gwendy, she doesn't even notice that they've happened. That, you know, she can date whoever she wants. Everyone wants to be friends with her. She's perfect. And she doesn't see herself as very much different throughout it. And not only that, but eventually it gets to the point where she doesn't know whether the box is causing things or she's causing things.
Yeah, I actually wanted to ask you what you thought of the fact that they kind of tied Jim Jones into this, and she focused on, you know, a specific area and country, and then she finds out that the mass murder, suicide, drinking the Kool-Aid thing with Jim Jones happened, and you really get a sense that bringing a true event like that into play is something that King also loves to do. Obviously, you have all of 112263 that does that, mm-hmm. but this really felt like they were trying to give a big enough true event that enough people would be familiar with to where it would kind of be a gut punch for our main character.
It was a huge gut punch to her because she you know, she has nightmares about this. She felt that it was her fault because she obviously went through and pressed the button. But then at the end, we have her being told that, no, he was crazy and that was going to happen anyway. But you can't tell if that's a lie or the truth. It just so happened to be the place that she picked. Was it going to happen? Was she just the catalyst? I love alternate history in stories like this. So it was just such a nice, wonderful touch.
It's one of those things that I've never really spent too much time thinking about until I read 11-22-63, because I had watched the show. So then I picked up on this much more easily, I would say, in this than just glossing over it and being like, oh, okay, they mentioned Jim Jones. Yeah, whatever, who cares? But you really understand that King does a lot of research. Not him personally at this point. He has had research assistants over the years. And it's just so well thought out, because for the time period it's taking place, you have to think about, okay, what year is it? What big event happened right around this time that we can implement into the story? One, without, you know, offending people. I don't think 11-22-63 was ever really considered offensive by any means, as far as I know. But playing that what if game is something we've seen in media for so long. And one of the big examples I like to use is the Marvel comics that are literally titled What If. It takes your beloved characters and kind of changes everything about them, you know, like, what if Spider-Man wasn't a hero kind of thing. And I really like that. And while this didn't do that exactly, it was kind of like, hey, what if our actions really do have an impact on a larger scale?
One thing that King has definitely been doing really well with, because he's done this several times, not just in this, but in other things, but that he picks historical events that are so a part of society that it just feels natural to have them slip in. Yes, this is totally appropriate to have for the timeline, but I mean, how many times have you heard people joke about saying, don't drink the Kool-Aid and things like that, or everything surrounding the Kennedy situation, things like that? These are pieces that are so a part of American society that it's totally natural to have them in this place and be able to warp and change them into stories.
Yeah. And the idea that this box has so much power too. It's just like, we all know that's extremely unrealistic, but he makes you believe it, and he makes his characters believe it, which is crucial, because if they don't believe it, then we're not going to believe it. And we see tragedy come while all of these good things are happening to Gwendy. You have Olive committing suicide off of what they called the suicide stairs that Gwendy would run up and down when she was trying to lose all of that weight. Frankie attacks Harry with the box and kills him. Then Gwendy uses the box to kill Frankie, which, because he quite literally disappears into thin air, no one is aware of that except for her. So she's holding this guilt inside of her, even though she had every right to do what she did. And 10 years later, she encounters Richard Ferris again and returns the box, and she's finally able to get that off her chest. And by 10 years later, I mean 10 years since he gave her the box, not 10 years after the event with Frankie. But I just really, really thought that all of Gwendy's actions still had consequences. It was just a matter of how much she cared about those consequences. Like when she had her falling out with Olive, she tried texting her and things like that, but she didn't necessarily think about it all the time. Eventually, she was barely remembering Olive's name.
This is one of those things that we're left with more questions about the box.
Yeah.
Instead of answers, because we have no way of exactly knowing exactly how much power the box has. Obviously, it can make chocolates. It can make the coins. It doesn't necessarily have to destroy things completely, as we saw, because it was three different kinds of destruction,
yep,
quote, that we saw from the box. But then we saw things outside of it too, whether it was Olive's committing suicide or her bully getting into an accident after catcalling her and trying to assault her the first time. So the box does seemingly have a will that's connected to Gwendy, but can still be, you know, enacted without her pressing any of those buttons.
One other question I have for you about Gwendy in particular. What do you think of the idea that she wants to be a writer? Because anyone who has read a good amount of King novels knows that he loves to put writers in his stories. You know, I've talked about this on numerous occasions because it happens so frequently, but it really feels like, and because I haven't read Gwendy's Magic Feather yet, I don't know what time period that takes place during, but it feels like they kind of left these little tidbits for us so that they could continue the story if they wanted to, and clearly they did want to.
I mean, it's not a Stephen King story if there isn't a Stephen King self-insert. There always has to be a writer character. I genuinely did like Gwendy in this. I was surprised to find that Gwendy was a female character. I fully expected Gwendy to be the name of some creature. I expected it to be the man in black on the front of the cover itself with the box, but it was a nice change of pace. I want to know whose idea it was to have Gwendy be a female character and act the way that she does, because I don't think she acts like most of King's usual female characters. She is very smart and very zoned in on everything that she does. I'm honestly genuinely excited to go forward and read what I guess is now going to be a trilogy. Something about this that I really enjoyed was the fact that it is very much a modern horror story, even though it takes place in the 70s. What I mean by that is this feels like something that you would find on like r/No Sleep in terms of both length and the overall feeling of it. And that's not a bad thing. You know, I, you know, indulge in those stories a lot. But you feel this uncomfortable burden of caring for the button box right along with Gwendy, her attempts to hide it, utilize it, and live a normal life with it. She goes to great lengths to keep this box, you know, hidden. But it's not an intense horror. It's not a horror where you expect something to jump out at you. But throughout this, it feels like there's this overbearing sensation of responsibility and the thought of everything has its price. When will it be paid? Along with the, you know, the general universal horror of getting older and things changing.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up the fact that this centers around a female character, because I've been thinking lately as to, you know, who the heroes and villains are in King's stories. And obviously in some, it's very clear cut. The Losers Club are the heroes, Pennywise the villain, and others are villains as well in that story. You have The Shining, where you really have Dick kind of coming to the rescue by helping Danny through everything. And I would argue the hotel itself is the villain more so than Jack Torrance. Mm-hmm. And you have all of these characters who kind of fall into this gray area, because we can't necessarily think of Gwendy as either a victim, villain, or a hero, really, in my opinion, because no one made her talk to the strange man on the bench when she was a kid. She chose to do that, even though everything she was going through in her head told her not to. And then she was able to resist the box and the chocolates for a while, then couldn't resist them anymore. And then, you know, Frankie, obviously a villain, but she still kills him, and he's a person. He's not this creature or vampire or, you know, otherworldly monster, if you will. So it's really hard to know where to place Gwendy, like, no pun intended, what box to place her in.
Well, and I think that's just the thing. She's just a person.
And I like that.
Exactly. Like, there's no, you know, making her incredibly weak and ineffective or abused in a way that she is completely broken. She is just a person going through life who just happens to have a magical box that could destroy parts of the world, whether that be actual physical destruction or wiping out, you know, people's lives.
And I will correct myself real quick here. She is very clearly a victim when being attacked by Frankie. That wasn't what I meant. I meant in the grander scheme of things, she isn't like Carrie, who is a victim of her classmates and her mother and everyone around her, basically, with one or two exceptions. You know, she understands that her parents have problems, but her parents aren't really taking the problems out on her in the same way that Margaret White does with Carrie. So
they don't even get names.
Yeah, that was what I meant in the grander sense of this character coming across as a victim from the start. You know, this is something that happens at the tail end. And I think they did a good job of not making us necessarily love or hate her. There are moments where you really want to love Gwendy as a character, but really she just feels like this real person. She's not a hero we're supposed to worship.
No. For me, she is definitely someone that I feel it's easy to kind of put yourself in the shoes of in terms of going through life. You know, even in the moment where she is a victim and she is being attacked, she thinks so quick on her feet. And that scene is so short in terms of like immediately getting it done. That's why I think Chismar wrote that part and not King, because it was very quick. But Gwendy is a character that is just, I know for some people that would be boring, that she's not a very, quote, strong character who's very loud, and we just kind of drift through her life with her. But there's something nice about that in terms mm-hmm. of waiting for the other shoe to drop in terms of like what's going to happen.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I feel like I'm just going to keep repeating myself here. So, Panda, is there anything else you want to touch on?
No, I've got final thoughts, though, when you're ready for them.
Hit me with those final thoughts and a rating for this.
Overall, I would say that this is a light and kind of mysterious read, but it gives you a little forehead kiss of horror to tuck you in. I definitely think this is something you should read if you're a fan of Stephen King's short story work and the overall linking to the Stephen King universe, particularly anything involving Castle Rock. This is one that I think you should pick up. If we're going to go through a 1 through 10 rating, I'm honestly going to give it a 7. I love Stephen King's short story work. And like I said, I'm a fan of r/No Sleep. And this definitely had that modern, spooky online writing feel to it.
Yeah, this is sitting at a 4 out of 5 for me, so 8 out of 10, if you will. And I haven't loved his short stories, but I've really loved his novellas, because I think with the short stories, because I was reading them in collections, and there's so many of them in the collections, it was really hard for me to just sit with them and really get into them, because it was like, okay, on to the next. But with the novellas, you have more time to spend with the characters, you know. And this one being a standalone, I didn't have to read 3 other novellas at the same time either. So it was nice to see that some of these are being published as standalones. And I know some of the older ones are too. Like, I have a copy of The Long Walk, even though it's in the Bachman books and things like that. But yeah, overall, really enjoyed this. I have heard not as great things about Gwendy's Magic Feather, but I'm still excited to check it out and see how things wrap up when the new book comes out. I'm not 100% sure I'm covering Gwendy's Magic Feather just yet as a regular episode, but stay tuned. I might do it for a bonus episode.
And one thing about this is, even though there is a sequel and there's going to be a third one, if you don't want to read those, I feel this is strong enough to be a standalone story. If you are okay with stories that end in such a way that you don't get those answers, you like that mystery at the end, this is a good story for that, if this is all you want to read. And like we said, it is a very quick read. Knock it out in 2 hours.
Especially with pictures. Love it when there are pictures included.
Yes, this is definitely one you want to have a physical copy of the book in your hand and not just do audio. Nothing wrong with just audio, but the pictures really do add to this.
Yeah. Well, Panda, that is all we have today. Thank you so much for joining me to discuss Gwendy's Button Box.
Happy to do it.
All right, that does it for this episode of Chat Cemetery. You can support the podcast on Patreon for $1 a month. You'll get a thank you on the show. For $2 a month, I will send you a Chat Cemetery sticker. And if you want to follow us on social media, you can do so at Chat Cemetery on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. You could also rate and review the show. That's a huge help. And as always, thank you for listening, and we hope you enjoy the rest of your day.